Good day. Today's Thursday, 2nd October 2025, and as I make this programme, there is a lot of anticipation about a speech that President Putin of Russia is going to give at the Valdai Conference, which is taking place in Russia. Now, Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, says that this speech will not deal with so much with the situation in Ukraine. It will not discuss in detail the diplomacy there or anything of that kind. It will be a rather broad brush speech dealing with the general situation in the world and the way in which the Russians see the global situation evolving. However, there will be a question and answer session after the speech, and quite often the most interesting responses, or at least the most revealing ones, come over the course of that. So tomorrow, no doubt, I shall be discussing this speech in detail and perhaps also some of Putin's answers to the various questions which have been put to him. Anyway, that's the Russian side of things. On the part of the West, we have more talk, more fighting talk, war talk, more talk of escalation. And of course, perhaps the most eye-opening, the most, in fact, disturbing information comes again from the United States. And the Wall Street Journal tells us that President Trump has now signed off on a change of policy. Whereas previously, when the Ukrainians sought to carry out strikes, deep strikes into Russia with drones and missiles, the Ukrainians had to seek US intelligence assistance prior to every such strike. Now the intelligence assistance is going to be provided on a blanket basis. Ukraine will no longer need to seek advice and permission from the United States prior to each strike. Now, that is a change of policy, and it does have implications. It does mean, presumably, that the Ukrainians will have more flexibility in carrying out their drone and missile attacks against pre-2014 Russia in the future. It's perhaps worth pointing out that the Ukrainians have had this kind of blanket permission and assistance from the United States in terms of drone and missile strikes that they have been carrying out on the territory of pre-2014 Ukraine, including, of course, Crimea. And I can't say that this intelligence help provided by the United States has in that territory made a dramatic difference in the war, just saying. But one shouldn't underestimate or overlook the importance of what is being discussed here. It is surely, if it is nothing else, another clear sign that the President of the United States, Donald Trump, that the United States altogether, the government of the United States, is moving towards escalation of the war, is now looking towards supplying long-range missiles to Ukraine. The Biden administration policy of last year of permitting strikes deep into Russian territory, pre-2014 Russian territory, a policy which President Trump at one point said that he vehemently opposed. Well, it looks as if his administration is about to embrace it again. It did no good for the Ukrainians before, and I don't expect it will do any good for them either. But it is an important and ominous escalation. And of course, it is a crossing of a genuine Russian red line. Now, having said all of that, one should not, again, overlook some of the logistical problems, because the United States is clearing the way for intelligence support to be provided to Ukraine to conduct deep missile strikes inside Russia. And there's been much talk about the United States supplying missiles to carry out strikes against Russia. The Wall Street Journal spoke about Tomahawk missiles, though it said that no final decision had been made. And it also talked about a new missile called the Barracuda, which also no decision to supply it so far has been made. In my previous program, I spoke about how it was clear to me that General Kellogg, at least, does seem to be committed to supplying the Tomahawk missile to Ukraine, though it is unclear how that is going to be done, given the serious logistic problems. Anyway, let's just explore a little further the question of the missiles. Now, over the course of several programs, I have pointed out, and various others, Jennifer Kavanaugh, for example, on responsible statecraft, but many others too, have pointed out that there is, as of this time, no fully in-service ground-launched version of the Tomahawk missile system. There is the Aegis offshore system, which is a fixed-point system located on the territories of Poland and Romania, which could potentially be used to launch Tomahawk missiles, though there is no word yet that it has been converted to that. But as I've discussed in previous programs, fixed launch installations in Ukraine would be quickly detected by the Russians and would be quickly destroyed by them. There is also the Typhon system, which is road mobile. It is massive. It is incredibly complex. It can only operate on what I guess are heavily metalled surfaced roads. It would probably also be a relatively easy target for the Russians to track. And I suspect that the logistics of maintaining such a system, the Typhon system, in combat would be enormous and well beyond what would be possible on the territory of Ukraine. Now, as I have discussed in recent programs, there is, at least in theory, the possibility of the United States mounting the Tomahawk missile on a simpler truck, operating a simpler version of the Tomahawk, a simpler launch version of the Tomahawk than the Typhon system. But as I have also pointed out, so far, as I am aware, no such simpler system exists. There is apparently no plan that anybody seems to know of to create such a system. There are probably all kinds of logistical and technical problems that would have to be resolved in creating such a system. And US industry has never proved particularly effective in improvising launch systems of this kind in conditions of war. At least it hasn't been for the last 30, 40, 50 years. Now, that might mean that there are significant problems about deploying Tomahawk systems to Ukraine. And I know that some people believe that it is unrealistic and cannot be done. Well, what about this other missile, the Barracuda? We're told that this is a much lighter, much simpler, much cheaper system than the Tomahawk system, that it is designed for ease of production, that it can be produced in large numbers, and that that would make it an obvious candidate to supply to Ukraine. There are, however, again, problems, which is that from what I have been able to understand, the Barracuda does not exist at the present time, as an operational missile. It is not yet in series production. It is a concept. Prototypes exist. They're going through a testing program, parts of which are being carried out in Taiwan. There's no word yet as to how well or not well that is going. If we're talking about setting up a production line to produce these missiles in quantity, well, that we're probably some time away from that. And again, taking into account industrial realities, it will probably take a fair amount of time before this missile is indeed produced in quantity. It's a little bit like the air-to-surface missile that we were hearing so much about 2 weeks ago, the one that where Ukraine was expected to receive 3,500 of them. It turned out that apart from some prototypes, which had been tested in the spring, so far no such missiles in fact exist or have been placed in volume production, in series production. So at the moment, an American plan to conduct deep missile strikes into Russia using American missiles suffers from the problem that there may not be any missiles with which to conduct that kind of missile offensive. There are serious problems with the Tomahawk, and I'm not even talking about the risks of using a strategic system in that sort of way. And the alternative, the Barracuda, relates to a missile which, apart from prototypes, so far does not actually exist. Well, there might be alternatives. One alternative is the Flamingo system that the Ukrainians put on show about 3-4 weeks ago. But I was reading in the British media, I think it was the London Times, that this missile actually also has not yet been put in volume production. And, well, I've already discussed in many programmes how this big, heavy, old missile, or rather not maybe old missile, but missile designed to rather old concepts, would probably not be very effective against the very advanced Russian air defence system. So there's the Flamingo. There was the Sapsan system that Ukraine itself was creating. The Russians have at various times claimed that they have knocked this missile program back and knocked it far back. Maybe. Zelensky was talking about a missile offensive, as I remember, by the end of July at one point, and it has not materialised. So it looks as if the Sapsan system might not be available, at least for a while. I wonder whether the missile that people are thinking about is once again the Taurus missile. That missile does exist. Not, it must be said, in enormous quantities, but it could just reach Moscow. It could target Russian energy and military facilities in Western Russia. It has the range to do it. It is a modern missile. It is said to be stealthy, and that supposedly makes it more difficult to shoot down. And I have at various times speculated that Germany has already probably delivered some examples of this missile to Ukraine, though the Germans themselves have denied it. But about 2 weeks ago, the Russian intelligence agency, the SVR, said that Taurus missiles were in effect in Ukraine. Any attempt by Germany to pretend that this was a Ukrainian-produced missile rather than a German one would fool no one, which, of course, was a statement from the Russians that might be taken to mean that this system, this missile, is indeed already in Ukraine and might be available for use. Just saying. So I wonder that whether, at the end of the day, all of this talk about Tomahawks and JASSM missiles, which are apparently also in short supply, the JASSMs is one of the missiles of which the Pentagon is prioritising production. Anyway, all of this talk of JASSMs and Tomahawks and Barracudas isn't, in fact, an exercise in misdirection, and that the actual missile that is going to be used in this missile offensive is the Taurus missile. That is the missile that's been planned, in which case the change of policy that Trump has made, allowing intelligence to be used to conduct strikes inside Russia, is as much a signal to the Germans and perhaps the French and the British as it is to the Ukrainians, because it is their missiles, the Taurus first and foremost, but such remaining examples of the Scalp and Storm Shadow missile as still exists, and the British and the French still have, well, those missiles might be used in this offensive as well, at least in terms of attacks on Western Russia. This is, of course, a guess on my part, but it is as good as any. Well, anyway, what difference can these missiles make? When attempts were made to use the ATACMS, which was talked up as a game-changing missile, when that was used in late 2023 and throughout last year, it made little difference, and the Ukrainians quickly ran through 500 of them. The Storm Shadows and the Scalps were somewhat effective at the start, but they eventually lost effectiveness as well. I suspect that if the Taurus missile is used, it will get through. Some of them will get through. Some of them will do actual damage fairly quickly. But as repeatedly happens, the Russian air defense system will rapidly adapt to the challenge and will quickly get on top of the Taurus missile. I remember reading earlier in the war that the life span of a new Western weapon system in terms of full effectiveness in the conflict in Ukraine is around 6 weeks. Beyond 6 weeks, the Russians managed to get on top of it. Now, that then brings me to what the Russians, for their part, are doing. And over the course of last night, the Russians conducted another massive drone and missile attack across Ukraine. And Kiev, again, was heavily attacked last night, mostly with drones, from what I can tell. But otherwise, the major targets of this latest Russian drone and missile attack were the various Ukrainian energy facilities, energy producing facilities across Ukrainian territory. It looks as if the Russians are resuming what John Helmer has referred to as the electricity war, that they're once again targeting the Ukrainian energy system. They have recently been targeting the Ukrainian railway system. Many of these attacks on the energy system are justified by the Russians as neat, necessary, in order to stop trains, in order to disrupt Ukrainian troop and supply deployments, which rely heavily on the effective, efficient operation of the railway system. And, well, that may be true, but of course destroying energy facilities, power stations and those sort of things, that inevitably is going to make the life of Ukrainian civilians much more difficult again this winter. And even as this attack was underway, an article appeared in the Financial Times, and it was about the effective collapse of Ukraine's air defense system. And for a time, it was the lead article in the Financial Times, and it said that Russian missile upgrade outpaces Ukraine's Patriot defenses. Kiev's interception rates fall as enemy strikes dodge US interceptors in final seconds. Months of devastating Russian air attacks suggest Moscow has succeeded in altering its missiles to evade Ukraine's air defenses, according to Ukrainian and Western officials. Bombardments that targeted Ukrainian drone makers this summer were a prominent example of Russia improving its ballistic missiles to better defeat US Patriot batteries, current and former Ukrainian and Western officials told the Financial Times. Russia was likely to have modified its Iskander-M mobile system, which launches missiles with an estimated range of up to 500 kilometres, as well as Kinzhal air-launched ballistic missiles, which can fly up to 480 kilometres, they added. The missiles now follow a typical trajectory before diverting and plunging into a steep terminal dive or executing the manoeuvres that confuse and avoid Patriot interceptors. It is a game changer for Russia, said one former Ukrainian official, with Kiev also contending with slower deliveries of air defense interceptors from the United States. The missile campaign has destroyed key military facilities and critical infrastructure ahead of the winter. And then we're given some statistics, which, by the way, take with a massive pinch of salt. Ukraine's ballistic missile interception rate improved over the summer, reaching 37% in July, but it plummeted to 6% in September, despite fewer launches, according to public Ukrainian Air Force data compiled by the London-based Centre for Information Resilience and analysed by the Financial Times. And Ukraine's Air Force on Wednesday reported all four Iskander-M missiles fired overnight had eluded the country's defences and hit their targets. And we're also told further on in the article that though Russian cruise missiles can be taken down with less sophisticated air defences, updates have made it harder to do so. So even Russian cruise missiles, the KH-101s, for example, and the Kalibr missiles, are less easy for the Ukrainians to shoot down than had previously been the case. Now, I am going to take this entire article with a massive cascade of salt, because in my opinion, Ukrainian success in shooting down Russian missiles, and by the way, Russian drones, has always been much less than the Ukrainians have been claiming. What I think has happened is that as the attacks, the latest Russian attacks, have focused increasingly on Kiev and its immediate environs, it has become increasingly difficult for the Ukrainians to deny the obvious, which is that the Russian missiles and drones are getting through. And the article admits that one of the things that perhaps shocked the West and made the Westerners finally realise that Russian missiles and drones were at least were indeed getting through was the fact that the Russians were able to conduct precision strikes on Ukrainian facilities near the former British consulate and the European Union's representative office in Kiev. So that made it very difficult for the Ukrainians to preserve the narrative that they were being successful in their air interception raids. Just saying. So, anyway, put that aside, we see that as the winter approaches, as supplies of Patriot missiles and other air defense missiles to Ukraine dwindle, and the reason that they're dwindling is not because of any reluctance by the United States to supply these missiles. It is because they are now in extremely short supply. Anyway, as the supplies of these missiles dwindle, as their lack of effectiveness becomes even more clear, Ukraine is exposed to further strikes by the Russians and the Russian drone, and missile offensive against Ukraine continues to escalate. It's a drone and missile offensive which is underway. It is already doing massive damage to Ukraine. It has been doing massive damage to Ukraine since October 2022. But one gets the sense that even the Ukrainians are now starting to sense that a tipping point has been reached. And in a kind of a way, the Financial Times article tells us the same thing. Even as this offensive continues, we see that the United States desperately looking for ways to balance this, talking up Tomahawk missiles, but failing to answer the basic questions of how they could be deployed, and talking up the Barracuda system, which, as I said, at the moment does not exist in quantity, and perhaps looking at the Taurus missile. But the Taurus missile also does not exist in quantity, though at least it is an operational system. And apparently Germany, the most it can spare is 150, which is not going to make a significant difference against a country as vast and as well defended from aerial attack as Russia, of course, is. So anyway, this is the situation in the sky today. But let's go back to President Trump and his decision to authorize deep missile strikes into Ukraine. You get here a growing signs of the anger and frustration in Washington. And I'm going to say straightforwardly, for me, there's much about this decision which goes back to that phrase that I've used previously about government by tantrum. Donald Trump became president of the United States, wedded to General Kellogg's plan, which basically was to freeze the conflict. He appears to have hoped or expected that this would win him the Nobel Peace Prize, something that I find completely incredible, by the way. But he now talks about it constantly, and I don't think we can have any doubts about that anymore. But also, no doubt, he had some idea that if he did win, he did freeze the conflict in Ukraine, he could achieve other things too. He could move, he could advance the plan to withdraw American troops, to some extent at least, from Europe, to redeploy them to the Pacific. And he perhaps also hoped that offers of economic cooperation with the Russians, development of Arctic resources and all of that would be a bait a bribe, if you prefer, that could persuade the Russians to start to distance themselves from the Chinese. And there is a kind of strategic rationale behind this as well, because the United States, arguably, in fact, unquestionably, is severely overextended around the world. It doesn't have limitless military resources. It wants to divert resources from Europe. So it wants at least a stable relationship with the Russians if it is going to redeploy them to the Far East. And of course, there is a further factor at play as well, which is that ultimately the US strategy in against China is a sea blockade. There's an article in the Chinese media that again discusses it. The idea is to blockade Chinese merchant shipping, to close the Straits of Malacca and other straits in the Pacific region. Obviously, that would stop Chinese exports, but it would also prevent China from importing food and energy products and other raw materials. And this has been discussed in the United States, as I remember, since about 2011, maybe even before. Certainly, it was being talked about whilst Barack Obama was president of the United States. Incredible, though that seemed to me at the time. And that, of course, remains to a great extent the plan. And the Chinese knew that it was the plan. And for that reason, they responded by launching their Belt and Road Initiative, and why they have been working very hard to develop alternative sources of supply for energy, raw materials and food that are provided by the Eurasian hinterland and can be supplied to China through pipelines and road and railway links and don't need to reach China by sea. Now, this is a sophisticated response from China to this potential threat. But of course, the key player in it is going to be Russia, because Russia, far and away, is by far the most important country. It's the biggest country in the world, of course, but it is by far the most important country in terms of Eurasia in supplying food, raw materials and energy, including perhaps lithium ore and other things like that to China. And which is in a position to do so by land. And that is what the Power of Siberia pipelines are all about. That is what the establishment of various road and railway links are about as well. It explains, in the end, the key importance of Russia for China, why Russia is as important to China as China is to Russia, in terms of their joint strategic partnership. Now, obviously, what the United States wants to do, if it is going to make the sea blockade plan against China succeed, is it wants to break this partnership. And as I've discussed in many programs on this channel, an article back in the National Interest published in August 2021, by Aaron Wes Mitchell, who, by the way, as I didn't know at the time, is a personal friend of Elbridge Colby, the Pentagon official who has been most consistently pushing the pivot to Asia and the challenge against China. Anyway, Mr. Aaron Wes Mitchell proposed that the way to break the Chinese-Russian partnership was to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia, using Ukraine to do so, and that would then cause regime change in Moscow, and that would open the way for the Americans to gain control of Russian foreign policy in a way that would isolate China and make China again vulnerable to this sea blockade that the Americans are seeking to impose upon it. That was all set out in that article in the National Interest in August 2021. Well, that desire to break this partnership still exists. There's been an extraordinary article by the former Canadian businessman, Conrad Black, who is a friend of Donald Trump's and has had recent meetings with him and who may represent his views, in which you can see the full extent of the paranoia, the fear that the Chinese-Russian strategic partnership generates amongst some people in Washington. Because Conrad Black talks about how Russia might lease Siberia to China, which could settle Siberia with 30 to 40 million settlers and develop Siberia in its own interests and obtain all the oil and strategic minerals and food and all of that from Siberia itself. And what a complete disaster that would be for the West. That the Chinese, of course, have no such plan, that this is a fantasy. But you can see, again, the extent to which China is the focus and the fear about it. And you can also get a sense of the way in which the United States understands the relationship between China and Russia and cannot bring itself to understand why the Russians should prefer the alignment with China against them. Anyway, Wes Mitchell's article came out shortly after the summit meeting between Biden and Putin, which took place in June 2021 in Geneva. Over the course of that summit meeting, as we now know, Biden brought up Russia's relations with China and tried to get Putin to turn away from China towards the United States. Putin responded that the relationship with China was not up for negotiation. I am going to suggest that something not dissimilar may have happened at this summit meeting, which took place in Anchorage just a few weeks ago. Just as the Americans came away from the Geneva summit in June 2021, angry and frustrated, and it was this that led to the whole series of diplomatic and political decisions, which ultimately culminated in the launch by Russia of the special military operation and the massive sanctions attack that the United States and the Europeans launched against Russia in February 2022. So I suspect the meeting in Anchorage, at which I guess the Russians again basically showed that they were not interested in sacrificing their relations with China and agreeing to a freeze of the conflict in Ukraine in order to move closer to the United States, that the disappointment the United States has with the outcome of the Alaska summit, a disappointment underlined by the pictures that came out of China, the film that came out of China just a short time later, where with the pictures of President Putin with Xi Jinping and China and Russia moving forward with their strategic partnership and Prime Minister Modi of India also being there, that the frustration and anger that all that produced is what has now led as it has become increasingly clear that what Putin said in Anchorage, he actually meant. Anyway, that probably explains the president's frustration, Donald Trump's own frustration, and his extreme anger, and the decisions, these reckless decisions to launch missile strikes against Russia, which we see being unveiled now. And I would add that the fact that the Russians have not agreed to trilateral meetings between Putin, Trump, and Zelensky, as I said at the time, there was no reason to think that they ever had done, that the Russians had not agreed to bilateral meetings between Putin and Zelensky. And again, there was no reason to think that they had done so. Anyway, all of that perhaps made even more clear to the Americans and made it finally fully clear to the Americans that the Russians are indeed sticking to their position. And, well, you can get a sense of the anger and frustration in Washington, obviously in part from Donald Trump's own words. You can see it also in the rumours, which I expect are true, that his envoy, Steve Witkoff, who has at various times proposed a different approach to the Russians, that it seems that Witkoff intends to resign or leave his post as Trump's envoy by the end of this year. Instead of Kellogg going and Witkoff staying and taking over and pursuing rapprochement and détente with the Russians, it is Witkoff who is going and Kellogg who is staying. And that is arguably all you need to know. Anyway, quite apart from that, we've had a very interesting article on his Substack blog by Seymour Hersh. And again, he is in discussion with his source, who is not, in my opinion, always given Hersh truthful information, to put it mildly. But anyway, the source made absolutely clear again the frustration and anger in Washington that the Russians have refused to take the bait, that Putin has refused to water down or give up the objectives that he set out at the start of the special military operation, and which he reiterated in his speech to the foreign ministry on the 14th of June, 2024. And how, if you read the comments of this official, as Hersh is reporting them, how the United States has now again reverted to the Biden policy of basically trying to find some way to break Russia economically, except massive tariffs on China and all that can't be done. So you've got to try and do it in some other way. You do it militarily through missile strikes on its oil refineries and other energy installations, and attacks on its military bases in Western Russia and elsewhere, in the hope that that just possibly might get the Russians to change course. The Hersh article speaks incredibly, again, of tensions, potential tensions between Putin and the oligarchs. There seems to be no ability in Washington to understand that there are no oligarchs in Russia. But anyway, returning in effect to that policy, maximum pressure on the Russians in order to get these impossible people finally to back down, to capitulate, and then to subordinate themselves to the United States in the great duel against China, supposedly, as some American officials probably tell themselves, in their own interests, which are better known to those officials, no doubt, than they are to the Russians themselves. Anyway, I wonder how long this period of anger is going to last, because ultimately what failed for Biden is not going to succeed with Trump. The stories, as I discussed in my program yesterday, of Ukrainian success in the battlefronts is simply wrong. I saw more reports this morning. The Russians continue to advance in Zaporozhye region. They're coming, they're close now to attacking the village of Uspenivka, and they are inside the village of Poltavka. And if you look at the map, they're very close to Guliapolia, the city of Guliapolia from the east. They're already very close to the city from the south, and they're also very close to cutting the supply roads to this city too. So the situation in the Zaporozhye region continues to go from bad to worse. The Russians continue to advance elsewhere, further north in Dnipro region. Redoka had an interesting discussion of the fighting around the fortified village of Novopavlovka, and says that the Russians are now well close to having all of the supply roads to this important village surrounded. I read a very interesting article by a, comment by a Ukrainian soldier who said that the Russians control all of the supply roads into Pokrovsk, and that the only way that Ukrainians can now enter or exit Pokrovsk is on foot. Any vehicle, be it a car or a motorcycle, will be immediately targeted and destroyed by Russian drones. And anyway, that again largely corroborates Redovka's account of the battle in Pokrovsk. I've already discussed how Ukrainian claims to have encircled the Russians northeast of Pokrovsk appear to be completely untrue. And this morning, there were panicked statements from Ukrainian commentators that the Russians are now storming the central areas of Kupiansk, that the whole north and western part of the town has fallen, and that the Ukrainians within Kupiansk are being pushed right back to the western bank of the Oskol River. And there's been more news in other places, Siversk and other places, but I'm not going to discuss that in any detail in this program. Now, about the deteriorating military situation on the battlefields, there's been a very interesting article by none other than General Zaluzhny, Valery Zaluzhny, who currently is Ukraine's ambassador to Britain, which is a kind of convenient exile, you might say, but who was, of course, until the early part of 2024, he was the overall military commander of the Ukrainian armed forces. He ran into all kinds of conflicts with President Zelensky, and eventually President Zelensky sacked him, and Zaluzhny has as a result gone in effect into exile as Ukraine's ambassador to Britain. Anyway, Zaluzhny has discussed the state of the battle. He has referred back to an article he wrote for the British magazine The Economist in 2023, in which he said that the war was in stalemate and that the only way to achieve a breakthrough was through new technologies, though he didn't specify what they were. He now says that though the war still is mostly in stalemate, he nonetheless admits that the Russians are gradually breaking the stalemate, that the Russians indeed are starting to turn the battle to their advantage. And interestingly, and very importantly, Zaluzhny for the first time admitted that the Russians have been pursuing, operating, conducting a strategy of attrition in Ukraine, and that this attrition is playing out to Russia's advantage. It's most unusual because the Ukrainians, and of course the Western media, have generally wanted to avoid discussion of attrition. They continue to be focused on territorial conquest. You constantly read in the Western media that the Russians have only advanced by 11 kilometers over the course of a single week or something of that kind. And Zaluzhny, by contrast, says no, that is not what the Russians are doing at all. He puts it like this. He says that until a way is found to escape, for Ukraine to escape this corner, Russia, having sufficient manpower to bury our positions and to infiltrate, will continue to wear down physically our troops, combining assaults with the aim of inflicting maximum losses. In this strategy of war of attrition, such losses are deliberately accepted. Combat is intended to produce a level of losses that becomes unacceptable for us, whilst at the same time maintaining constant social tension, in particular through intensified mobilization. As a result, such systematic exhaustion of forces and means will sooner or later lead to the complete burnout of our defending forces. Now, we've been saying all of this on the Duran for, well, some time now, years I think now, certainly since the Battle of Bakhmut, when the Russians basically developed this strategy. And we're not the only people who've been saying it. Brian Beletic has also been talking about it in many programs, and others have been talking about it too. In the West, they don't want to talk about it. They talk always about Ukraine achieving enormous victories, how the Russians are suffering these tremendous losses, how the Russian advance is an advance that's taking place at a crawl, that in effect, it is Ukraine that is winning the war, as General Kellogg said, and the Russians who are losing the war because they're not making those great breakthroughs, those big red arrow offensives, beloved of people in the West. Anyway, Zaluzhny, who knows something about the war, after all, he was Ukraine's military commander, differs. He says that the Russians are physically wearing the Ukrainians down, that their aim is to inflict maximum losses, that the Ukrainians have no real alternative but to accept those losses because otherwise they're surrendering positions which would undermine the integrity of their defences, that this is a war of attrition. I've described it as aggressive attrition. Combat, he would repeat his actual words, is intended to produce a level of loss that becomes unacceptable for us, whilst at the same time maintaining constant social tension, in particular through intensified mobilization. As a result, such systematic exhaustion of forces and means will sooner or later lead to the complete burnout of the defending forces. And in this long article, Zeluzhny also admits that in technological terms, in the areas of technology where he suggested back in his article in The Economist in 2023, that it was only through achieving technological mastery that Ukraine could prevail. In the key area of drone warfare, technological mastery and numbers has instead been acquired by the Russians. Now, Zeluzhny does not, in this article, suggest negotiations. He comes up with proposals of how the war could be won after all, but it's important to say that he's no longer talking about defeating the Russians on the battlefield. The title of his article is Finding Some Means to Prevent the Russians from Winning and Dictating the Outcome of the War. Anyway, that some way to stop the Russians from winning. And he talks about developing a clear strategy and mechanisms for advancing cutting-edge defense technologies, securing the necessary cadre of specialists, tackling the most difficult challenge, access to chips, and exploiting Ukraine's existing defense technology exports to build security alliances and to tap the technological and scientific potential of future partners. And lastly, ensure Russia's complete exclusion from international scientific and technological cooperation. That doesn't seem to me like a plan. And I don't believe that Zeluzhny thinks it's a plan. It's a succession of wish lists. It's a wish list of things that the West and Ukraine have been trying to achieve since February 2022 and have been failing to achieve. I mean, how, for example, do you achieve Russia's complete exclusion from international scientific and technological cooperation when Russia has a strategic partnership with China, which alongside the United States is one of the world leaders, one of the two world leaders in science and technology, as well as being the world's biggest manufacturing power? It can't be done. So, anyway, Zeluzhny understands the reality of the war, that Ukraine is being fought to exhaustion, that its reserves are in effect being depleted as it tries to cling on to the defence line that it created in Donbass, because it knows perfectly well that if that defence line is lost, then it doesn't have the means to hold the Russians in open country. And by the way, on this point, again, there's been much discussion about the fact that the Russians continue to produce vast quantities of armour, but that only small numbers of tanks and armoured vehicles are now being used by the Russians on the battlefields. The reason for that is that, again, according to Russian military doctrine, deep battle, the task of breaking through defences is for the artillery and the air force and the infantry. Deep battle can happen when the defence lines are broken, and that's when the heavy armour will roll into battle, the reserve armies, and push not just to the Dnieper, perhaps, but even beyond. Anyway, let's not get ahead of ourselves. So, Zeluzhny has no plan, even though he understands what the Russians are doing. The Americans have no plan. The only plan Trump came up with was Kellogg's plan. He never had the courage to do what we and others urged him to do at the start of his presidency. We simply wash his hands of the whole thing and walk away. He's indicated in his recent Truth Social post that the problem now is for the Europeans to sort out. But even then, he's obviously too angry that the Russians have not agreed to his freeze idea, and too frightened that he is going to be blamed if Ukraine goes down. So he gets constantly drawn back into these bad plans of massive sanctions, as we saw in the summer, or missile strikes, deep missile strikes against the Russians, all of those things. He won't walk away, and the Europeans, for their part, aren't prepared to do diplomacy either. Now, the Europeans have just had a meeting in Copenhagen, and it turns out that they weren't able to agree on anything. They didn't agree on confiscating the Russian assets, or on Ursula and Friedrich Merz's plan to use the Russian assets to float the 140 billion euro loan for Ukraine. Apparently, there was a lot of acrimony. The meeting lasted twice as long as intended, but they weren't able to move forward with that. They weren't able to move forward either with plans to create a drone wall or anything of that kind to prevent Russian drones or aircraft pushing deeper into European territory. Not that I believe myself that for the moment this is a real danger. Of course, if we start to get deep missile strikes into Russia, then it becomes much more realistic. But bear in mind, the Russians possess a missile now, the Oreshnik, of which, by the way, I have been told, and I can't corroborate this, but that the Russians now have 140 already completed and being inducted into service. Anyway, the Russians have a missile that can reach any target in Europe and against which there is no ability to intercept exists. So anyway, the Europeans were not able to agree to that. The Germans were sceptical about the drone wall. Emmanuel Macron was hostile to the idea of confiscating in any form the Russian assets. And in this, of course, the Belgian Prime Minister joined him. So they weren't able to come up with any decision. The G7 published a statement about how they remain determined to try to find ways to strangle Russian oil receipts, and that they were prepared to impose secondary sanctions or sanctions of some kind against states and entities which help the Russians bypass Western sanctions. By the way, that has been said many times. This has been talked about by the West and threatened by the West since at least 2022. Of course, given Lindsey Graham's bone-crushing sanctions plan and all that, it can't be discounted that they might eventually get round to imposing the kind of tariffs that Donald Trump was talking about against countries like India and China. But I don't think myself they will. But anyway, regardless of that, they weren't able to agree. But that doesn't mean that they are moderating their language. The French detained a tanker that was carrying Russian oil. They detained it. They have not impounded it, apparently, and it will be released and allowed eventually, or so the French say, to proceed on its journey. But they've taken seriously Zelensky's hint that some of the mysterious drones that have been appearing over airports in Denmark and such places were launched from these shadow fleet tankers, and we're told that the French are examining the ship and have arrested two crew members, presumably in order to try to find proof or evidence of that. And Macron has come out with an incredible, unbelievably belligerent statement, saying that, you know, if everything else fails, well, we can start seizing Russian ships or ships that trade with Russia on the high seas. We might not hold them indefinitely, but we could hold them for defined periods of time, you know, 1 day, 2 days, 1 week, 3 weeks, and that will disrupt the entire energy trade and all that, the Russian energy trade, and that could be effective. Now, Nikolai Patrushev, the senior Russian official who used to be Putin's national security advisor, but who now is the official who supervises both the Russian Navy and the Russian merchant fleet and the Russian shipbuilding program, way back in the summer, said that this was the West's plan, that this was what the West intended to do. And he spoke about the Russians creating a convoy system for their ships, which would be defended, protected by Russian warships. And this has already been tested out successfully on at least one occasion, by the way. So we perhaps could see that. It's not impossible that the Chinese and maybe even the Indians might become involved. And that would be a massive complication as well. But bear in mind that when people start playing the game of seizing ships on the high seas, others can join in that game also. The United States has found that with Iran, or if you prefer, Iran has found that with the United States. There have been several attempts when the Americans and the Israelis and others have seized tankers carrying Iranian oil, and the Iranians have responded by seizing other tankers. And, well, we know what Iranian allies like the Houthis have been doing, interfering with shipping in the Red Sea. And, of course, the Russians can do that too. And some of their friends perhaps might be prevailed to do it for them. I think this is a disastrous idea. I think all of these attempts to try to interfere with the Russian oil trade are disastrous ideas. Attacks on Russian refineries, even with missiles, are most unlikely, so it seems to me, to have a significant effect on Russia's economy overall. They might create some gasoline shortages, but the Russians can always deal with that problem through rationing or whatever, and they're very good at that. But what all of these attempts to disrupt the Russian energy industry might do, and to see ships on the high seas might also do, is that they could potentially lead to oil shortages, which will inevitably affect the oil price. And that is not going to work out well in Europe or in the United States. Now, I read a very interesting article in Unheard about the problems in the US and other economies. It was by a man called John Rapley. And he says that it's a misconception that the boom in the American stock market is solely a product of US AI euphoria. I mean, there may be an element of that, but it is not the proximate cause. The proximate cause continues to be massive overspending by the US government. Overspending during the pandemic, overspending during the Biden presidency, overspending that is continuing after Donald Trump's big, beautiful bill went into law, which has increased the budget deficit still further. And there is a huge amount of money swirling around in the United States and in the global economy as a result. And this isn't only because there's overspending or over excess money emission by the United States. All Western central banks are to a lesser or greater extent involved in this. And the result is massive inflation, some of which takes the form of inflation of goods, rises price increases of goods, which people buy and consume, but which inevitably mostly ends in massive inflation of asset prices, property prices, and shares and stocks and things of that kind. And he points out the extraordinary distortions in the economy that this is causing. And he also points out, by the way, that if you take the price of gold as your measure, then despite all the claims about American economic expansion, the American economy is basically stuck where it was as far back as 1990. Well, I am not going to go into that. But anyway, given that this is so, do you really want to add another oil price spiral on top of that? The reason inflation took off further still in 2022, though nobody says this, is because of the Biden administration's attempt with its European allies to restrict Russian energy exports, which led to energy shortages across Europe and ultimately the United States as well, which were then, of course, cured by higher prices. Isn't what is being proposed now going to do exactly the same? And who will be the beneficiaries of those higher energy prices? Well, logically, the energy producers, amongst whom, of course, Russia is one. So I don't really understand the economic or geopolitical or military logic of any of this. I've discussed in the past how a lot of policy in the United States today seems to be policy by tantrum. The Americans didn't get what they wanted in Geneva when Biden and Putin met in June 2021, and the result was a war in Ukraine and an economic and social and political crisis in Europe, which has never gone away, and a war in Ukraine which the West is losing. Donald Trump didn't perhaps get what he wanted out of the summit meeting in Anchorage. And anyway, his attempts to pull the Russians away from the Chinese are looking increasingly like they have failed. Already we are looking at extreme steps taken in anger to respond to this, which can only be counterproductive in the end. Truly, the more things in the West go round, the more they go round. We don't seem to be able to learn anything. We just go on repeating the same mistakes again and again. And again. And as for Donald Trump, he probably won't be happy if he ever were to hear it said, but it seems to me that he is becoming Joe Biden all over again. Well, that's where I finish today's programme. There'll be more from me soon. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. And last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.